yesterday, as we ended our lectures, I was introducing Schopenhauer as the first person on the alternative route in response to Kant. The first response we looked at was Hegel's attempt to out-rationalize Kant's reasoning. Okay, Hegel improves on or gives a supra-rationality, a dialectical logic that he thinks will enable us to get beyond the phenomenal-noumenal distinction that Kant had introduced. Ultimate reality is going to be accessible through reason, according to Hegel. Now, that didn't work, and as I said, Hegel really is the end of the line. Rationalism, I mean, what are you going to do after Hegel? There are many Hegelians, and idealism lives on for a century, but in terms of general presentation of options for us, that's the end of that line. So we go over to this other way to respond to Kant's distinction between things as they appear to us and ultimate reality. And we're going to look today at a series of responses that are more on the subjective and anti-rational side, what I have called the more mystical response to the Kantian dilemma. And in this, those who follow this perspective are going to say that you can get in touch with ultimate reality, but it won't be by means of reason. It's not going to be the Hegelian, Kantian game of trying to outthink, you know, this dilemma and this problem. It's rather, we can only know things as they appear, phenomena, by means of reason, but there are other ways to be in touch with ultimate reality besides the reasoning process. And the first one that we look at is Schopenhauer and his voluntarism and mysticism. Arthur Schopenhauer was born in 1788. He died in 1860. He was born into a wealthy family in Danzig, Germany. However, much of his childhood was spent in France and England. His family was made up of wealthy merchants. They lived a highly cultured life. He learned refined taste in his family. And apparently this helped him to become, and even his supporters would say this, a very vain and snobbish individual. He studied philosophy at Göttingen and Berlin. He studied under Fichte and Schleiermacher. Remember Schleiermacher, we're going to be talking about him later on today. And in 1820, he lectured at the University of Berlin, and he purposely set the time of his lectures to compete with Hegel's lectures at the University of Berlin, which may have been one of the reasons he had such little success, because Hegel was the rave of the day. Schopenhauer stood over against Hegel, and he wanted to give his lectures at the very same time. He didn't get a whole lot of attention. He spent part of his life traveling in Switzerland and Italy. In the last 30 years of his life, he lived in virtual seclusion in Frankfurt, Germany. Schopenhauer is remembered as being an elegant essayist. He was very talented as a communicator, as a writer. His writing is free of obscurity. It's not weighed down with a lot of jargon. And he was well known for his aphorisms, which is going to be similar to another person we'll look at today, and that is Friedrich Nietzsche. I point that out not just as a biological coincidence, but I think there may be something that reflects the character of their philosophy, too. Both Schopenhauer and Nietzsche are not convinced that reason is going to help us get in touch with ultimate reality. So they don't stress so much, and they're not so well known for reasoning out a system of thought as they are known for their zingers, you know, these little aphoristic expressions that make you stop and think and maybe come to a deeper understanding of things. Schopenhauer attracted the attention of Tolstoy and Conrad and Proust and Mann. He influenced the thinking of Wagner and Nietzsche. And many people today remember him for an infamous essay, very bitter essay he wrote entitled On Women. Some people have concluded that Schopenhauer was a misogynist. I only bring that up because that's of contemporary interest, but you should know that he was like that. And since I already told you he has influenced Nietzsche and is aphoristic like Nietzsche, Nietzsche has also been interpreted as a hater of women. He certainly was unabashed in his chauvinism, Nietzsche, with respect to women. Okay, well, back to Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer was heavily influenced by Kant. In fact, his first philosophical treatise delimits the kinds of reasons that are legitimate in philosophical explanations. That's very Kantian. What kind of reasons are legitimate when you're doing philosophy? And so in 1813, he published On the Fourfold Root of the Principle of Sufficient Reason. On the Fourfold Root of the Principle of Sufficient Reason. Schopenhauer wrote other books as well that we're going to pay closer attention to in trying to understand his unique contribution to Western thought. In 1836, he wrote a book entitled Will in Nature. Will in Nature. In 1841, Two Basic Problems of Ethics. And in 1851, he published a book of essays that finally brought him some attention and popularity. Up to this point, he had been rather obscure, but his essays, especially because of his literary style, did bring him some attention. And those essays were entitled Parurga und Paralegomena. We don't have an English translation. The major work, however, for which Schopenhauer is remembered, and the one that we're going to pay attention to now, was published in 1818 when he was only 30 years old, and it's entitled The World as Will and Idea. The World as Will and Idea, although the German word for idea might also be translated representation. The World as Will and Idea, or representation. It was later amplified a great deal and republished in 1844. Schopenhauer's World as Will and Idea assumes Kant's distinction between the phenomenal and the noumenal realms. Okay, so he agrees with Kant. He says, ultimate reality is to be distinguished from things as they appear, the phenomenal realm of our experience. And he applied that distinction both to the self and to the world. To the self and to the world. That is, there's two perspectives on the self. The self appears as an object of perception. That is, when you consider yourself, you perceive your body, you're an object of perception, you cognitively think through who you are, what you are. But then there's also the self as it is in itself. That is the real self, the ultimate self. I don't want to lose anybody by this vocabulary. If you have the real self that's behind the appearance of the self. That's all he's saying here. So how do you appear as a self? What are you in the phenomenal sense? But then what are you really behind the appearance? And according to Schopenhauer, what we are, ultimately, though you don't get this in perception, is we are a manifestation of will. We are a manifestation of will. He applied Kant's phenomenal noumenal distinction to the world as well. We've been talking about the subject of knowing. Now, the object, or the world itself, is to be seen as idea or as will. Look at the title of the book, The World as Will and Idea. Remember, idea has the sense of representation. Now, we can represent the world to ourselves. We do that in terms of how it appears to our senses. But that isn't the way the world really is. Ultimately, the world is will. So the world and the self, both the subject and the object knowledge, ultimately are a manifestation of raw will, if you will, desire. But that isn't the way things appear. When we look at ourselves, we see a body. We look at the world. We think we see objects out there, you know, trees and tables and things of that nature. Okay, so he begins with Kant. Both the self and the world can be seen phenomenally. They can be seen noumenally. And perhaps the most important thing for us to remember about Schopenhauer in terms of the history of thought, the development of Western thought and culture, is that he had an extremely pessimistic view of reason. An extremely pessimistic view of reason. According to Schopenhauer, all of our reasoning is really subordinated to non-rational, covert and distorting forces of the will. All of our reasoning is subordinated to the non-rational, that is, the distorting, covert forces of the will. When somebody shows up to argue something and tries to be very scholarly and intellectual and gives their reasoning, Schopenhauer says, that person has chosen, you know, what they want to say and where they are going. And all the reasoning that's put in there is but an expression of that underlying will and desire that's in the individual. Nobody is objective and looks simply at the truth and then chooses something. It's rather people have drives, they have desires in them, and then the reasoning is their covert explanation. And when they reason, it turns out they distort their desires and the will that is within them. You may want to make a mental note here, kind of a marker, that Freud is going to come back, you know, to this kind of thinking. This view influenced Freud in his view of man. Reasoning is really subject to will then, and that's why Schopenhauer is called a voluntarist. Those of you who've been in the earlier classes know how we've defined voluntarism as the view that reason is subordinate to will, to willpower or desire. The medieval voluntarist theologians said that that is true of God, that the most important force in God is his sovereignty, his will, not reason. And therefore, if God chooses to, he can do things that are contrary to his reasoning and what he has said previously. That is one version of voluntarism. Schopenhauer is a voluntarist with respect to human nature. Human nature is ultimately and really will, drive, desire. And our reasoning is in the service of will. That's one way in which we can see his pessimistic view of reason. Secondly, he had a pessimistic view of reason because, according to him, understanding, the word understanding he used for what is based on perception. What is based on perception, that is understanding, falsely projects subjective events as objective qualities. All right, I'm having an experience, a perceptual experience right now of, well, put it simply, a television at the back of the room. Now, is there really an object out there at the back of the room with the color and shape and so forth that I'm perceiving? Schopenhauer said, I don't know. I'm actually engaged in confused thinking here, because what I think is a television at the back of the room, which is black and about 2.5 feet high and so forth, is nothing more but an event in me. See, there's a perceptual event taking place in my eyes, right? And I make the mistake of projecting what is happening in me as an objective quality out there. And so, according to Schopenhauer, perception, or what he called understanding, falsely projects an internal event onto what we think is the objective world and its qualities out there. Given our sensory makeup, the world will always appear as idea to us. Perception will lead us to have an idea of the world, but those ideas are projections that are confused and distorted. According to him, differences in intellect between animals, dull human beings, and intelligent human beings is only a matter of degree of sophistication. We're all on a continuum here: smart people, stupid people, and animals. We all make the mistake of relying on perception, thinking there are objective qualities in the world out there. Now, one advantage man has, according to Schopenhauer, is that his thinking is conceptual, whereas animal thinking is not conceptual. Conceptual thinking at least makes communication possible. Okay, the fact that we can have ideas, concepts, based on our perceptions enables us to remember what we have seen and communicate it to somebody else. But now, you got to be paying attention this morning, because though that makes us, that gives us an ability animals don't have, that's not all that helpful, because what we are communicating are our ideas or concepts. What has he said about them? They're confused. They're distortions. And so what we communicate based on perception, that is, our concepts that capture our perceptions, our ideas, as we communicate them about the world, falsify the uniqueness and the continuity of reality. All of our ideas are cognitively inadequate. Because, according to Schopenhauer, when philosophy gains abstract, universal, and conceptual knowledge, which is communicable, when it attempts to articulate experience in a system of abstract concepts, a rationalistic structure, it's distorting the true nature of reality. Because philosophy and reasoning dissect experience. And in dissecting experience, kills it. We have an immediate awareness of the world and reality all about us. And when we reflect on it philosophically, we start drawing distinctions. We dissect. We get rational. We try to systematize. And you know what happens when you do that? You lose the experience. Isn't that true? You're all having a great experience eating filet mignon. And the person across the table gets really rational with you and starts dissecting the experience and explaining to you how the taste buds work and what this meat is made of and where it came from and how it's been prepared and all that. Now, is what that person is saying over there capturing your experience of the filet mignon? Of course not. And to the degree that you pay attention to what he's saying, you're going to lose your enjoyment and savoring of that steak. And so, yes, conceptual thinking give something to human beings that's beyond the animals. But all conceptual thinking is distorting in its character because it dissects experience and kills the experience. And so there's really two things you need to capture here in your notes. First, the perceptual side of our thinking is based on a false projection, thinking that the world is of such and such a way when in fact the world is what we're calling the world is really events in our own cortex, if you will, our own mind. And so perception is false, and the ideas based on perception, as we try to philosophize and gain universal abstract knowledge that we can communicate, those ideas dissect and kill the experience. Reality is continuous. It's unique. And when we subject it to the working of a philosopher, it's no longer continuous. It's now broken up into its various parts. It's no longer unique and experienced. It's something that's dull and dissected. Now, Schopenhauer has an even more pessimistic view of reason. I've given you two ways in which he's pessimistic. The first is reason is subordinated to will. Secondly, reasoning, both in its perceptual and conceptual sides, is misleading and destroys experience for what it really is. But then thirdly, as philosophy attempts to articulate experience in a system of abstract concepts, Schopenhauer says, which experiences are we supposed to systematize? When philosophy aims to articulate experience, the philosopher chooses which experiences are important. You see, in that sense, how reasoning is based on will. Are my lectures a living example and proof of what Schopenhauer has just said? Well, they sure are. You notice I haven't mentioned a whole lot of people who wrote books in the 19th century and in my previous classes throughout Western culture. There are plenty of people I haven't mentioned, plenty of ideas, plenty of movements, plenty of attitudes, and so forth. Why? Because I had to decide which ones were important. They're the ones that I try to communicate to you. Or if you follow a standard textbook, if you're looking at W.T. Jones, he has decided which ideas are worthy of mention. So when philosophers teach philosophy, they have to be selective. Well, when you do philosophy, doing direct philosophy and not just looking at the history of philosophy, you're also being selective. What part of human experience is important? What's relevant? What needs to be articulated and systematized? And so it turns out that what we call reason, as we're doing philosophy, is an expression of our own choices. And then, as we've said, when we articulate the experiences that we've chosen as the important ones, we destroy their immediacy. And so we falsify them. So perception is false. It projects a world out there with qualities which, in fact, are just subjective events inside us. Conceptualization, philosophy, is false because it gives the idea that it's being objective when, in fact, it's an expression of what you've chosen to be important. And what you articulate destroys the immediacy of the experience that's articulated, so it's false anyway. See why Schopenhauer is considered a pessimist? Boy, this is not a very high view of reasoning. Schopenhauer says, good riddance. Reasoning's not the sort of thing we ought to be all that important. We should make that important in our experience anyway. The third way in which, or is this the fourth? Okay, we'll use your number system. The fourth way in which we can see the pessimistic view of reason in Schopenhauer, is that according to him, reasoning actually damages our power of decision. And in that sense, reasoning is an obstacle. It impedes our acting. What is man ultimately, class, if you're Schopenhauer?
Will.
What is the world ultimately?
Will.
And so if reasoning impedes our ability to make decisions, to act, that is to express will, then reasoning gets in the way of reality, doesn't it? Isn't this beautiful? How does reasoning do that? You have to admit, Schopenhauer has captured something which is accurate in your experience. Sometimes we just get so weighed down with the doubt and error in our thinking, with care and with sorrow, as he said, that we're unable to make decisions. Okay? I can think back times in my life, although it's painful to remember them, I can think back times in my life when a certain sorrowful events took place. And it's very true. It just kind of like froze my will. I didn't want to make decisions. I didn't want to think hard. I didn't want to be, you know, pressed upon to be responsible for what I was deciding. I just wanted to withdraw. And so rather than expressing the reality of what I am and what reality is, will, my reasoning, the sorrow and so forth in me, made me pull back and become more passive. Well, it's not just emotional blockage, you know, that where our reasoning makes us feel sorry and therefore we don't express our will, but sometimes when we're trying to be very reasonable, what do? Okay, so you decide you want to buy a new car. Boy, that's exciting, you know? Go out there, make the decision. But you don't have a lot of money, and you don't want to make a mistake, and so what do? You pull out the consumer's reports, right? And you read the accounts, and you study them, and you have to systematize all these different qualities and criteria and so forth. And then you go to the dealership, and you hear one salesman give you the line on this car here, and you go, oh, that sounds pretty good, but not, like, maybe he's trying to oversell me here, I got to be careful. So you compare that with what a salesman over here says, and you consider what he has to say. So you've got all this reading and all this research and so forth, and so do you end up buying the car? Well, you struggle and you struggle. So rather than getting out there and asserting your will, reasoning, you see, becomes something that's an obstacle to you being real. Okay, question?
I just wanted to know, did anybody ever mention to Schopenhauer that in asserting all this testimony about reason, it's actually being very reasonable, is using reason to do that to begin with?
Yeah, we're going to come back to that. So in a sense, before you level your criticisms at these philosophers, hear them out, okay? So we get to the end of the line, then we can supplement what doesn't get said, but you know, try to let him get all this up on the board before you tear it down. But sure, he's trying to be reasonable in expressing what will is all about. So, what do you know about Schopenhauer? Heavily influenced by Kant, the phenomenal noumenal distinction. Secondly, a very pessimistic view of reason. Thirdly, according to him, reality in itself, ultimate reality, beyond appearances, beyond perception, beyond philosophical conceptualization, reality in itself is blind, irrational will. Now, who does this stand in utter contrast to? Well, who did he give his Berlin lectures in competition with?
Hegel.
According to Hegel, ultimate reality is what? Ultimate reality is what? I'm not hearing you.
Rational.
The real is the rational. And so, ultimately, it's Geist, it's spirit, it's mind. We don't see that just yet. It's working its way out through history, but it's mind or spirit that's developing. Isn't this fascinating? So what you have here is really two different idolatries. Hegel says reality is what part of human nature? Mind. Schopenhauer says, now you got it wrong. What's ultimate reality is will. In a couple of moments, we're going to get to a school of thought that says, no, ultimate reality is feeling. Okay. Now, when you're in the forest running around bumping into all these trees, you may not see that pattern, but I think it's fascinating when you kind of get in the helicopter and look down on the pattern of the forest and say, you can see this, it's so obvious, you know, it's like taking one aspect of our experience or of human nature and making that the main focus or interest. Well, for Schopenhauer, reality is blind, irrational will. Everything is an objectification of will. Everything is an objectification of will. And there's nothing to know, and here you want to put the word know, the verb to know, in quotes. There's nothing to know about ultimate reality except that it is blind struggle. Now, why did I say put know in quotation marks? Because remember, for Schopenhauer, knowing is restricted to what? Phenomenal thought. Distorting and false conceptualization. So we don't know ultimate reality in a rational sense as will. We experience it as will, as a blind struggle. It's pure will without any articulate structure. Pure will that is aimless. Make sure you get that. It's not as though he has this teleological conception that the universe is moving toward a particular aim or purpose. It's not going anywhere. It's just willpower. That's all. It's pure desire. It's not articulated. There's nothing to say about it. You cannot know it. It's just will, desire, without desiring any particular thing or having any reason for desiring. It's not a what or a why, it's just willpower. Now, I told you, we don't know about this. We don't know it rationally. We certainly don't perceive it. Well, for Schopenhauer, in addition to perceptual understanding and conceptual reasoning, man has another power, the power of intuition. Intuition here taken as direct, unmediated savoring of experience. Most of the time when you have used the English word intuition, it's been something like we speak of a woman's intuition. Okay? And so you may have a kind of more magical or mystical view of intuition than what Schopenhauer was getting at. Although in our use of the expression a woman's intuition, there is this sense of a direct and mediating savoring of experience. Okay, so a husband and wife are talking about somebody they've met at a business dinner or at a party. And the husband says, you know, I think I'm going to call on him in my business. He seems like a really good man. I'd like to get to know him better, so forth. And she says, no, I think you ought to stay away from him. Why? You know, and how women can be, right? Oh, I can't give you any reasons. Well, so this is the male approach, right? Well, I mean, if you can't convince my mind, if you can't give me reasons, then why should I believe this? Woman's intuition. Okay, now I can present it and make women look irrational and strange and weak, but I want to tell you something. I think there's something to woman's intuition. Women pick up on things that men are just blind to. They're dull. And let's go back to my illustration. Now, is this because the wife, let's say that she's right, the man that her husband wants to get involved in business turns out to be a rat, you know, deceptive and without integrity and so forth. Now, is that because she had some kind of occult ability to look into this person's heart and see the blackness of his heart? No. You know, that's the way many people think woman's intuition is, well, it's got to be some kind of almost demonic ability to see into people's hearts. No, it's rather that she picked up on something directly in her experience of this person. Wasn't mediated by a deliberating process of reasoning and conceptualization. But she had this direct experience. Maybe it's body language. Maybe it's the way he looked at his wife or looked at other women. You know? But the problem is, when we say maybe it's this, maybe it's that, the important thing is she can't put her finger on something and say, well, here's the argument. He looked at other women in a salacious way, you know, and so he obviously is not faithful to his wife. He probably won't be faithful in business either. That isn't how she drew her conclusion. She didn't go step by step discursively through the premises. It's just rather, I just have a bad feeling about that guy. Okay? So in even our expression, a woman's intuition, we have the notion that that Schopenhauer is getting at in our English translation of the word intuition. There's a direct and unmediated savoring of the experience. That direct experience is what tells us. Now, our intuitions are true. When we directly savor reality, our intuitions are true. Of course, there's a price to pay. You can't communicate it. And so you have intuition, which is true but incommunicable, or you have rational conceptualization, which is communicable but isn't true. You want to get that in your notes. That isn't just a cutesy comparison. That's really the heart of the matter here. Rational conceptualization enables us to communicate with each other. That's great, but what we're communicating is a distortion. It's not true. The way we know ultimate reality is not through reason and concepts. We know ultimate reality intuitively. We directly experience it. And that is accurate, but can't talk about it. It's inarticulate, can't be communicated. It's incommunicable. And so we're not nearly done with Schopenhauer, but along the way here, let's just kind of sum up. Schopenhauer started with the self. He's interested in the nature of the self. And this, he's like every one of the Enlightenment thinkers, from Descartes through Kant. What is the self? And Schopenhauer's approach is we intuit ourselves as will. What do you know about yourself? Not know rationally. What do you intuit about yourself? You intuit that your desire, your will, your activity. And then he went on by what I think is a false analogy, but nevertheless, he went on by means of analogy to say, like ourselves, the ultimate reality of the world is also will. Okay, you have a direct experience of yourself, right? I mean, you can't avoid that. You are yourselves. Now, what do you experience yourself? When you got up this morning, what did you experience of yourself? What did I just say? You got up. You did something. There is no self that isn't doing something. And why did you get up? Because you desired to go to class. Now, that desire may have been imposed on you, and you're just doing it to get a grade and get by. Or, for most of you, it's because you have such a love for Dr. Bonson's teaching, you say, I've got to get out of bed. We've got to get to class. I'll miss something that he's going to say. Whatever it is, from one extreme to the other, you made a decision. And you're making a decision to sit there and not to laugh out loud at my silly jokes, or to raise your hand, or to write your notes. Your experience of yourself all day long is an experience of what? Will.